You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, historian Rick Perlstein joins the show with his latest book on the rise of conservative politics in the 1960s and 1970s. We'll hear the story of Reaganland. Now, a bipartisan task force on racial disparities, policing, and public safety in Wisconsin is starting to take shape. That task force was announced late last month by Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss on the same day that Governor Tony Evers called a special session of the legislature to take up a series of policing-related bills. Republicans gaveled into that session, then immediately went into recess, saying more time and consensus was needed before moving forward with legislation. On Monday, WPR's The Morning Show talked to Republican Representative Jim Steinecke, co-chair of the task force. Now the newly announced Democratic co-chair joins the show. Sheila Stubbs is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 77th Assembly District in Madison. Representative Stubbs, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
You've been critical of Republicans in recent weeks for not taking votes on those policing bills from the governor I just mentioned and not moving more quickly. Can you talk about your decision to accept this invitation to join as co-chair of this task force?
Well, first, thank you for giving me this chance to have this really important interview. The reason I accepted is because Wisconsin is in a crisis. It's an urgency. It's an emergency. And we know the Black Wisconsinites make up only 7% of our population, but 44% of the population in prison. Wisconsin is the worst state to raise a Black family, and this is shameful. It's unacceptable, and our community deserves better. And I know firsthand that racism is a public health crisis, period. It has plagued the Black community for far too long. We need to address the systemic injustices with action. No more speeches, no more press conferences, but with action. So it is my duty as a legislature to come to the table and be the voice for our community. That's why I decided to do it.
You've mentioned the word urgency a lot. How do you hope to bring that sense of urgency to this task force with lawmakers from both parties and a lot of community members too?
Well, first and foremost, I think by coming together and having an array of voices that are outnumbered by elected officials and having the outside tell us, community organizers, grassroots organizations, not-for-profits, you know, others come inside of the Capitol and tell us the importance to move forward meaningful, common sense legislation, which is exactly what the governor has moved forward for this special session. And it's going to take other voices to help us shape that narrative in order to have, you know, meaningful policy that will pass. And we know that there's some policy that the Democrats, you know, we really love when there's policy the Republicans don't like we have. So we've got to come to the table, come to a consensus on behalf of all Wisconsinites and move some legislation when session starts up in January.
There's sometimes a sense that you start a task force to put things off and not take action now or maybe ever. Are you hopeful that members of both parties can come out of this task force and make changes come January?
I'm very hopeful. I'm optimistic. I wake up in the morning feeling that I can get things done. Number one, I am a worker. And people know that with my work ethics, I get to the table and I get things done. This is not a time for people to feel like they can do whatever they want to do. We have to answer very specific questions. Wisconsin is being watched by everyone across this nation and across the globe. We will be transforming the new criminal justice reform. And we must come up with solutions, right? We must come up with answers. We must address these really hard comments of police brutality and racial profiling and no knock warrants and no chokeholds, and really talk about reform as it relates to law enforcement and other aspects of a person's life, from education to juvenile justice to the economy to criminal justice reform. We have a lot to address, and I know that this task force will need to come up with answers. Failure isn't an option for me. It's my life. It is my passion. And I expect to go to the table and go to work along with other people to get some answers.
We're talking to Democratic State Assembly Representative Sheila Stubbs of Madison. She is the Democratic co-chair of an assembly task force on issues related to racial disparities in the state and police reform. Are you hearing things, Representative Stubbs, from Republicans, specific policy proposals that you look at and say, yes, I would be on board with that?
But right now, the only bills we have in front of us are the 9 bills that Governor Evers and the Legislative Black Caucus worked together to bring before us for the special session. I have heard that there are other bills out there, but what this task force really want to do is look at every bill that's been introduced in the Capitol and see where our consensus as a task force in order to move forward. And we know that it's clear that these problems can't be solved alone by legislators. And that's why investing in our community leaders is so important within this task force.
Is there a timeline of when you're going to be together, convene this, and start hearing from people?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Our first meeting is supposed to occur either the last week of September or the first week of October. And our work will need to be concluded by January in order to have the legislation introduced. It will be the first it will be the first section of bills introduced in January for the legislature.
I think there's a feeling of, I don't know, despair or pessimism or worry that these are problems that can't be fixed across the board. I mean, from African-Americans in Milwaukee, you hear the phrase sick and tired of being sick and tired. I think people watching Kenosha from the outside are worried about, you know, chaos in the streets. Do you feel a sense of optimism that you'd want to share with people who are worried that things just aren't going to get better?
Well, you know, I've always looked at it from a perspective that you could be on the outside looking in. You know, for people that are spectators or just looking out, I'm in the game, like I'm at the table, and I am a demander of reform. I've done that over and over again at the county level, from introducing an Office of Equity and Inclusion to calling racism a public health crisis. It has taken this type of reform to get things done. And I say this, it's a new day in the state of Wisconsin. When Wisconsinites went to the polls and elected Governor Evers, it was a new day, a day of change. And I still believe people have that same urgency of change now. And the demands are very clear. We want action. We don't want any more conversations. We need things done, and we need things done right now. And that's why this task force makeup, a membership, need to be those voices to come in and demand these real changes that are going to happen. So I'm excited to be at the table to work with grassroots organizers and not-for-profits who are really going to shape the outcome of this task force.
And as we wrap,
and faith-based communities as well.
As we wrap up, what are a couple of the items that the governor and the Black Caucus and the legislature came up with that you really hope are going to be front and center here?
Well, first, front and center is profiling. You know, my incident in 2018, I was out knocking on doors when someone called the police on me and thought I was a drug dealer. That is one of the bills that I'm real excited to move forward on in there. Excessive use of force, law enforcement standard bills, no chokeholds, no knock warrants. Those are a couple of just common sense bills that just need to be pushed forward. And I think that there's consensus on both sides, but it's finding that product that everyone can agree to, that is not going to be the perfect product for everyone, but it's a product that we have to move forward, and we must demand change. And as one of the co-chairs, that is exactly what I'm going to be sitting in that seat to do, to be the people's representative, because the will of the people is the law of the land.
Representative Stubbs, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sheila Stubbs is a Democratic state representative from Madison and co-chair of the new Speaker's Task Force on Racial Disparity. She talked to us about her hopes for the group's work in the months ahead. We heard from the Republican co-chair, Jim Steinecke, on Monday on The Morning Show. Coming up, a youth hockey program in the state just got a big boost in a nationwide contest. Find out more coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a youth hockey facility in Wisconsin is going to get an upgrade after being named a finalist in a nationwide competition. We'll find out what the program means to the local community and what they're going to do with the prize money. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a historic building that will soon be torn down.
The Sheboygan Armory has overlooked Lake Michigan for nearly 80 years. The Art Deco building that once housed an NBA team and welcomed world-famous performers like Bob Hope has a special place in the hearts of many Sheboyganites, but doesn't have much time left. Megan Hart brings us a look back on the history of the Sheboygan Armory.
The atmosphere at the Sheboygan Armory was electric during legendary North-South high school basketball games. Sherry Becker says students used to shake the benches so violently, she's surprised they didn't rip from the walls.
Games at the Armory were just absolutely fantastic and very memorable.
Becker was a senior at Sheboygan North High School in 1987. She had enough credits to finish classes early, so friends at South asked their teacher if she could join them for gym class. they learned a dance routine to perform at the North-South rivalry game at the Armory. Becker sat with her classmates from North and excused herself to the bathroom just before halftime. Little did her friends know she was about to cheer for the other team.
At the end of our routine, we spelled out South on the floor, so I made sure I was on top of the H so I could turn around and wave to all my friends. And I did. It was so much fun. I turned around and they just started yelling, "Traitor! Traitor!"
Like many Sheboyganites, Becker has lots of good memories from the Armory. She used to work setting up professional wrestling rings around Wisconsin, including at the Armory. As a teenager, Becker snuck out to see the band Rat perform there. But now she says she's too sad to drive by the building. They're clearing it out before tearing it down. The Sheboygan Armory was completed in 1942 as one of the last projects of the Works Progress Administration, the federal stimulus program aimed at lifting the U.S. from the Great Depression through widespread employment. Beth Dipple is executive director of the Sheboygan County Historical Research Center. She says unskilled workers were paid 40 cents an hour to finish the building.
But, when you weren't making anything, it was enough to put food on the table.
The whole building cost about $240,000 to complete, despite its elaborate design.
It's basically poured concrete, and they designed it so that in layers, the more people that could be employed, the better.
The Armory was built to house a division of the National Guard and Sheboygan's professional basketball team. It was one of the NBA's original arenas. It went on to host acts like Alice Cooper and Sheboygan's own Cordettes. Plus other community events like school dances, coin shows, and blood drives.
Probably 25 years, it was full almost every weekend and an awful lot of time during the week. And then everybody else after that point in time started to build their own facilities.
Today, North and South high schools have their own gyms. The city began to contemplate the building's future years ago. Officials say the Armory was expensive to maintain and challenging to renovate. A space museum moved in briefly. A high school shop teacher considered working on it with his class. And a former NBA player even tried to make the Armory home to the Wisconsin Herd, the G League affiliate of the Milwaukee Bucks. Dipple says a lot of community members stepped up.
Anything and everything was tried. I mean, it was valiant efforts to try and figure out an adaptive reuse for this wonderful building. But it just didn't work.
The Armory's time has come. Now the Sheboygan County Historical Museum is focused on preserving its memory for the sake of future generations.
Over here we have items, so they did put a time capsule.
Executive Director Travis Gross grew up in Sheboygan.
I have to say, go North. I just have to say it.
He went to holiday fairs and watched the Harlem Globetrotters at the Armory, but some of his favorite moments there took place in the last 6 months, after its fate was sealed.
Because this is a story that's coming to an end. And to be able to get in there and, walk around, see all the rooms, nooks and crannies, see those seats and go, that's where I sat for that concert, that kind of thing. It's all very personal.
WPR's Megan Hart brought us the story on the Sheboygan Armory, an historic building that's scheduled to be torn down next year. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Hi, this is Judith Sears-Poisson, executive producer of Central Time on the Ideas Network. Just about everything you can imagine has changed in the past few months. Work, school, parenting, healthcare, and more. And unfortunately, it's hard to know when, if ever, we'll go back to anything that feels like normal life. Every day, the Central Time team works hard to bring you the most important and up-to-date information on life during the coronavirus pandemic. Whether it's new information on medical and health advances, advice on how to help children understand what's going on, or updates from public officials on topics like unemployment benefits, we want to help you get through this challenging time. And we want to know what you need to hear about and what concerns you have. We hope you'll email us at centraltime@wpr.org anytime with questions and comments about topics you'd like to hear about. Take care, and from all of us on the Central Time team, thanks for listening.
This is Central Time. The home of the River Falls Youth Hockey Program is about to get an upgrade. The organization was a second prize winner in this year's Kraft Hockeyville USA contest. It's put on by Kraft Heinz and the National Hockey League, along with its Players Association. Communities submit their story on why their rink should be honored, and the winner is determined by an online vote, and it gets money for building improvements. River Falls Youth Hockey gets $10,000 to upgrade its facility, known as the Wildcat Center, and it'll also get money for new equipment. Kaylin Wilson is president of the River Falls Youth Hockey Association. Kaylin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations on this award, and there's quite a story about this community effort that brought this hockey center together. Can you tell us how people came together to make this happen?
Sure, yes, it's been very exciting for us. It started late last winter and actually was delayed due to COVID. This all should have been decided back in April, but it started last winter. I believe it was February, we were nominated and we went through a rally phase where everybody got online and supported through social media and through Kraft Hockeyville's website and with pictures and information about our rink to get us into the top final four. And then the final four were announced in August, at the end of August, and there was a voting period then that occurred on August 29th. And we had to once again rally our community and get everybody and the message out there to get on and vote. We were one of four communities that were in the top final four. And the voting period happened and we landed as a second runner up. And we won, like you said, the $10,000 in rink upgrades and $10,000 in equipment, which is very exciting for our program.
Now, the Hockey Association, this facility, I understand it's run entirely by volunteers. Tell us a little bit about how it all works.
Yeah, 120% volunteer. So our program has about 200 children that skate in our youth program, and that goes from 4 years old in our Learn to Skate program all the way up and through Bantams right before high school. And we have about 200 kids. And our board of directors is 12 individuals, again, all volunteer run. And we really, our board divvies up our org chart and everything that needs to happen. And we really rally the rest of the parents and volunteers to make the rink run day to day, season after season. Without the commitment by parents and other volunteers, we wouldn't be able to offer this program for youth. We have no staff. We have no money for staff. We really look to the members in the association to bring their skills and their expertise to the table and provide that to us. And it happens.
Now, how important is youth hockey to the community and especially, I guess, to the kids in the community?
It's very important. It's our program has grown over the last several years after we created a Learn to Skate program to really try to get kids interested from a young age. The program has grown, and just the opportunity to play on a team sport and to learn those skills really helps develop the individuals grow and gain confidence and learn skills that they're really going to be using the rest of their lives. Even if they don't end up going to the NHL, as my son thinks he will, but even if they don't end up there, these skills that they're learning now and are part of their development for the rest of their life.
And this is their programs for boys and girls, if I understand correctly, right?
It is, boys and girls. Yep.
Now, is this a point of pride in the community that you pulled together no paid staff and made this great thing happen?
Oh, absolutely. We really had to get our community to rally. And we are a small community. I don't know if everybody knows where River Falls is. We are in the very far western part of Wisconsin. We're actually considered part of the Twin Cities Metro. We are across the river from St. Paul, about 20 miles out next to Hudson, Wisconsin. And we're right here in the St. Croix River Valley. We're a very small community, though, outside the metro. Right on the outer skirts, and our town is, I think, 15,000-20,000 people. Like I said, only 200 skaters. We have a Main Street area with businesses that were so willing and open to putting messages out on their reader boards, to handing out flyers, to getting information on their social media. The other sports youth organizations in River Falls were willing to send out information to all of their members. And we really just rallied around in our community and beyond to get those votes.
Now, what does the money from this national prize actually mean on the ground, or I guess on the ice in this case?
Yeah, that's a good question. We were actually just discussing this at our board meeting last night. So obviously the 10,000 in equipment, we're hoping we'll get to pick that equipment and decide what we need for the program. But in terms of the upgrades, the other $10,000 for the building, there's a lot of things that could be done. Obviously the need is greater than 10,000, but we really want to do something that's viable, that we can say, this is what we put the money towards, so that when people ask, we have a hard thing. We really could just let it be swallowed up into some bigger fund that needs more money, but we want to purchase some upgrades that we can say exactly what we bought. And I know one of those things that we discussed was a new heater for one of the locker rooms. You can imagine a locker room and a hockey rink. You want that to be a little heated. So that might be one of the things.
In our last minute or so, Kaylin, if somebody's listening out there in another community and thinking, oh, I'd like to pull together some kind of community project, whether it's a sport or a park or whatever activity, what would you say to give them a pep talk to try to rally the community together?
I would say just have a little patience, because it didn't happen overnight. And I can even distinctly remember after we were nominated, there was, of course, a small group that were really rallying and trying to get others on board. And one person came to me and they're like, you got to get the board involved. And I thought, oh man, you know, this does take a little bit of time. So have patience, but really it's the spirit and the passion that will drive that.
Kaylin, congratulations again, and thanks for sharing this with us.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Have a great afternoon.
You too. That's Kaylin Wilson, president of the River Falls Youth Hockey Association. We talked about the organization and their facility, the Wildcat Center, being a runner-up in a big national Kraft Hockeyville USA contest. Coming up, the author of a new book tells us about President Ronald Reagan's political rise and how his 1980 campaign helped shape the modern conservative movement. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, pollster Charles Franklin shares the results of the latest Marquette Law School survey looking at the presidential race, coronavirus policies, and more. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, in 1976, Ronald Reagan lost the Republican presidential primary to Gerald Ford, the party's sitting president. He was dismissed as too ideological and maybe even too old to be president. 8 years later, he swept the national election for his second term as president of the United States, winning all but one state. Our next guest has been chronicling what changed in American culture and politics during that time. Over a series of four books, he's documented the rise of conservatism here in America. He's here now to share his latest about the years leading up to Reagan's election. Rick Perlstein is a journalist, columnist, and author of the new book, Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here, Rob. You know, driving around as a very nerdy high school student in Milwaukee when growing up, I would listen to WHAD and I would always, you know, dream of being one of the authors who was interviewed, you and Terry Gross on WUWM. So, you know, it's always a pleasure coming back to the Ideas Network.
Well, you've reached the pinnacle now. There's nowhere to go but down from here, I guess.
Well, every 6 years, need it or not.
Well, you pack a lot into this new book, but I want to go even wider and talk about your project going from kind of the mid-1960s after Barry Goldwater got beaten in the presidential election up to the 1980s. Talk about this long-term project to trace the rise of conservatism.
Yeah, I've been working on this since 1997, so I've finished it up with this book. It's 23 years. It actually starts in the late 1950s when it's pretty much conventional wisdom that conservatism is not really relevant in American politics, that we're a center-left nation, that we're becoming a nation in which, you know, the government takes care of more and more basic functions, like, you know, we're now familiar with in Northern and Western Europe, that America is on its way to kind of ending its racial ordeal. And that people like Barry Goldwater, who was the guy who ended up winning the Republican nomination in 1964, were utter irrelevancies. So the first book I wrote about this was called Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. And it's about how Goldwater won that nomination, and it ends with his landslide loss against Lyndon Johnson. And the last page of the book is all these pundits saying that the Republican Party is literally dead as a part of American political life unless they purge the conservatives, which is pretty much what happens at the beginning of this book after Jimmy Carter wins in 1976. And in between, I wrote a book called Nixon Land, which was about how Richard Nixon really revitalized the appeal of the American right by weaponizing the resentments and fears of white middle-class Americans. And then the book in between is called The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. And it again finds the Republican Party being counted down and out because of Watergate and the Watergate class of Democratic congressmen that brought Congress to a 2-to-1 Democratic majority. You see a pattern here. That was about Ronald Reagan's first run for president in 1976. And then this book starts right where that left off, with one pundit saying that Ronald Reagan has about as much chance of becoming a presidential contender as Richard Nixon.
And you trace this concerted effort to take the Goldwater ideology in many ways and make it dominant ultimately in the Republican Party, and then to take that Republican Party and win elections. And there's one phrase that keeps, echoing through this book of one of the organizers of this effort: we organize discontent. Can you break that phrase down for us and talk about how that played out?
So Barry Goldwater, you know, loses in this terrible landslide, and he's the guy who just absolutely says exactly what's on his mind and exactly what he wants to do for the country. So when he writes this book called Conscience of a Conservative, which sells millions of copies, but mostly only to conservatives, he says he's for ending all agriculture subsidies. He's for ending the progressive income tax. He says that Brown versus the Board of Education is not based on sound law. He says we have to be willing to risk a nuclear war against the Soviet Union, and that the only reason we don't is because a craven fear of death has crept into the American American public. And, you know, conservatives love this, and they basically take over the party from the ground up, but in a very sort of conspiratorial way. It's not like a majority of Republicans want these kind of views. They use the rules, and they pretty much assume that the public, once they hear these ideas, will somehow fall in love with them. And of course, it's an utter flop. The big difference in the people who are organizing as conservatives in Jimmy Carter's presidency, they call themselves the New Right, is they realize that they can take the American public's much more broad-based fear and anxiety over the social changes of the 1960s, their fears about things like gay rights, their fears about things like feminism, their fears about things like crime and law and order in the form of gun control legislation, which, of course, they oppose. If they can take the public exactly where they are, even to stoke up those resentments, stoke up those fears, which they do with great aplomb, they can kind of seduce them into voting for candidates who do the stuff Barry Goldwater wanted to do, but have a much more broad mass appeal. And it works really well, to the extent that not only does Ronald Reagan win the presidency in a landslide in 1980, he does so with a preponderance of what are then called Reagan Democrats, who are former Democratic voters. Often they're union members. They're from places like Milwaukee. And they're people who are terrified of, their daughters getting pregnant or their sons saying they're gay and all that sort of stuff.
Talking to Rick Perlstein about his new book, Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. And Rick, you trace all these different groups, social groups and organizations that hadn't necessarily been overt political players in the 70s. They emerged as key election shaping forces, including evangelical Christianity, which Jimmy Carter did okay with evangelical Christians. Then what happened?
Yeah, it's a really interesting and ironic story. So you got to understand that evangelical Christians, fundamentalist Christians, basically categories that overlap. They might have been very culturally conservative in the way they lived their lives and the way they saw their world. But one thing they generally were not were political activists or even sometimes voters. There's a line in Romans enjoining Christians to cast their eyes above and not care about worldly things. And that was basically taken as an injunction to not get yourself messed up with politics, right? That's for Caesar, right? It's not the Lord's. And one result of all these social changes is that all these discontents begin to take political form because preachers, first of all, they completely give up something that was very dominant among conservative Christianity previous to this period, which was contention over theology, right? So so Southern Baptists decide they're not going to be mad at Pentecostals. Pentecostals decide they're not going to be mad at Mormons. They'll even work with Jews because the task is seen as so monumental to beat back the satanic forces of liberalism. So you have a bunch of very charismatic television preachers and a bunch of political organizers who are kind of working behind the scenes who are doing things like, for example, leading initiative campaigns on ballots around the country to repeal gay rights laws. You have Christians who are saying that the government doesn't have a right to regulate their schools. And the watershed for this is in 1979, when Jimmy Carter's IRS commissioner tightens up the rules for private schools that have basically sprung up in profusion since the 1960s because parents want to protect their kids from what they see as the snares of liberalism. They tighten the rules to prove that your school is not segregating. And it's not necessarily that these schools don't want to have Black students. In fact, I document that a lot of them went through extraordinary efforts to recruit Black students. But for example, in the South, a lot of these same preachers in the 1950s have been segregationist leaders, so Blacks didn't want to have anything to do with them. You know, they were very proud of the struggle to have been able to enter integrated public schools. But these preachers absolutely freak out at the idea that the government is telling them to run what they consider as adjuncts of their ministries and their churches. And that really is the watershed moment in which any kind of compunctions that preachers have of basically turning their churches into precinct organizations washes away. And a lot of that is financial, because what the IRS seems to be threatening is their tax exemptions. And without their tax exemptions, they're not going to be able to make their payrolls and all the rest. So I take the reader to this absolutely galvanizing, absolutely insane administrative hearing with the IRS, in which preacher after preacher stands up and says that they're willing to go to jail, they're willing to die to fight for their right, you know, not to fill out government forms and that sort of thing. And of course, by the next year, these preachers are all organizing their congregations to vote for Ronald Reagan, even though 4 years before, Jimmy Carter was really the first evangelical to run for president. But by that time, he's thrown his lot in with, for example, the movement to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, which is one of the galvanizing discontents that conservatives are organizing around. So Jimmy Carter had once been this evangelical hero, but he was a very old-fashioned evangelical in that he refused to base his legislating based on his understanding of scripture. It certainly informed his moral judgment, but the people who were saying that, for example, gay rights are unbiblical, Jimmy Carter was a mild supporter of gay rights, that sort of thing.
Talking to Rick Perlstein, author of several books on the conservative movement in the United States. We're talking about the new one, Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Reagan-era conservatism? What do you remember about the transition from President Carter to President Reagan? Were you politically engaged at the time? Were you inspired to get into politics because of Ronald Reagan? Positively or negatively, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the rise of Ronald Reagan and the forces that shaped modern American conservative politics with Rick Perlstein, author of several books on the topic. His newest is called Reaganland. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about the Reagan era? Did his win in 1980, if you were around then, surprise you in a good way, in a bad way? How did conservatism in America change with the presidency of Ronald Reagan? Call it with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rick, we were just talking about a change in evangelical Christian voters. Another big change, I hadn't realized this till I read it in your book, the first endorsement of a presidential candidate by the National Rifle Association, Ronald Reagan, in 1980. They underwent a big change in direction in the time period you cover in your book.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. The National Rifle Association began after the Civil War by former Civil War officers who were afraid that the marksmanship of American men was not up to snuff. So, you know, the next time a war came, you know, we wouldn't be able to shoot straight. And it really had nothing to do with gun control at first. And all the way through most of the 20th century, it was basically what you joined if you wanted to, you know, be a hunter and you wanted to learn about guns. And, you know, the American Rifleman magazine was mostly about outdoorsmen and, you know, target shooting. It was only with the rise in crime in the late 1960s and things like urban riots that you began to see a faction of the National Rifle Association organizing against gun control, whereas the people who were running the organization were pretty much supportive of things like mild gun control, banning what were then called Saturday night specials, which were, you know, cheap handguns that were believed to be preponderantly used in the commission of crimes. And you begin to see a faction organizing sedulously underground to take over the organization and turn it into a political machine for opposing all gun control. And the guy who's the head of this faction is this crazy, colorful guy named Harlan Carter, whose nickname is Bullethead. It was later revealed that he had been convicted of murdering a young Mexican immigrant that his family had believed had stealed poultry or something like that. The conviction was overturned on a technicality, but this guy was, you know, like Charlton Heston, you know, avant la lettre. And what they did was at the 1977 meeting, they used all sorts of procedural tricks and parliamentary tricks to undermine the leaders of the organization. And at 2 a.m., after, you know, all these kind of points of order and all the different things you do to take over a meeting, the smoke clears and these guys are in charge and they fire the entire staff. And they basically say, if you're interested in anything other than getting all the gun control laws off the books, you shouldn't be in our organization. And that becomes one of the many struts of this new right-wing coalition. And one of the people who had always been advocating for this was Ronald Reagan. So Ronald Reagan, after he was governor of California, basically he made a living by lecturing and doing a newspaper column and also doing a daily radio broadcast. And one of the radio broadcasts he gave in 1975 that I listened to in the archives, he said something that would become very familiar in the decades to come, which is that when you outlaw guns, the only people to have guns are outlaws. So this idea that this was all about disarming the good guys, and, you know, he would talk about, you know, the reason we have the Second Amendment is to protect ourselves from a tyrannical central government. And this kind of macho kind of John Wayne mentality becomes part of the Republican coalition, such that by 1980, yes, just like you say, the National Rifle Association for the first time says, yeah, we got a dog in this fight, you know. Ronald Reagan is for us. Jimmy Carter is against us. That was yet one more of these discontents that this new right political faction was organizing in order to unhorse liberalism in American politics.
Let's bring on a caller. 800-642-1234. Sarah is with us in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hey, Rob. Well, for some reason, this is funny to me. I just remember being 16 and Reagan, and I guess what was Carter up for re-election that year, and then And I just really didn't like Greg, and I can't remember exactly why, but I'm sure it was for environmental things. And there was a candidate here in Illinois named John Anderson, who I just really liked, and he was kind of a Republican, but he was into, like, conserving gas. So I was really for him. But then in 84, when Reagan was reelected, that was the first time I got a little bit involved. And I remember I wrote letters to the editor, and I was, like, talking to people, and then I was just so depressed. And my issues would be, like, Central America and then environment again.
Yes.
Sarah, thanks a lot for the call. Rick, I think it's fair to say Reagan probably got a lot of people involved in politics for him or against him.
Absolutely. He was a very polarizing figure. He certainly got a rise out of John Anderson from Rockford, Illinois. He's a really interesting figure because he had actually been an early adapter, shall we say, of Christian right politics. When he came to Congress in the 1960s, he actually introduced an amendment to the Constitution to make Christianity the official language of the United States. But he just kind of became more and more left-wing. He was a Republican, but he was very disgusted with the Vietnam War. He was very excited about the civil rights movement. And by 1968, he's a liberal. And they say every 2 years, you can tell when it's election time in Rockford, Illinois, because John Anderson cuts his hair. Right. Because in Washington, he was a liberal. But, you know, this is making him more and more alienated from the conservatives in Rockford, Illinois. But he was a very prominent Republican. He was the House whip and he was beloved by reporters. He was quite brilliant. He was quite eloquent. And in 1978, he got the political scare of his life because one of these early preachers, a guy named Lyons, challenges him for his nomination for reelection for his, like, you know, 20th term. And John Anderson almost loses. And he realized that the Republican Party is being taken over by forces he hardly recognizes in the form of these right-wing preachers and all the rest. And so he runs for president. And in 1980, there's a very crowded field. You have about a dozen candidates at the beginning because Jimmy Carter seems to be such a weak president. But only one of them, John Anderson, represents what is actually a very long and distinguished strain of Republican liberalism. And he just is handed defeat after defeat. And then he decides that the public is so dissatisfied with both choices on the ballot for 1980 that maybe he can run as an independent. So he does manage to get on the ballot in all 50 states. And he his main Sarah's right. His main campaign promise was a 50-cent gas tax, you know, to encourage preservation with a kind of 50% kind of rebate of the payroll tax. And he was very popular among kind of media elites. Walter Cronkite fell in love with him. He almost sounds like a partisan on the CBS Evening News. And there's once an article in the New Republic that Walter Cronkite had agreed to become John Anderson's running mate. But anyway, long story short, John Anderson gets about 8% of the vote, and a lot of that vote comes from Jimmy Carter, because John Anderson, by election day, is even more disgusted with Jimmy Carter than he is for Ronald Reagan. And one place he wins is New York State. Ronald Reagan wins is New York State, and that's almost certainly because John Anderson took so many votes from Ronald Reagan. I mean, from Jimmy Carter.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just 30 seconds or so left. Rick, where do you go from here? This has been a long project for you with these multiple books on this long, evolving story.
I think I'm going to write a shorter book kind of concanting the wisdom I've derived about, you know, how the Republican Party operates and how liberals like me can defeat it in future elections.
And just briefly, so much of the landscape we take for granted now, it evolved in this time period that you just wrapped up in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and that's when I was growing up. You know, I talk about in the book, I talk about Star Wars, I talk about Superman, all these movies in which the public was kind of longing for these narratives of innocence, good guys and bad guys, instead of the kind of moral ambiguities of the earlier 70s.
Rick, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Rob. Bye-bye.
Rick Perlstein is a journalist, columnist, and author of several books on American conservatism. His latest book, the last one in this series, is called Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. Still time for you to share your thoughts and your memories of that time if you're around for that era in American politics. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Kate and her guests look at ongoing efforts to get lead out of drinking water and why it's such a health risk, especially for children. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a new report tracks the use of force by police departments in Wisconsin's three biggest cities. We'll look at the findings, what they mean for ongoing questions about police reform, and our guest makes the case for more data collection, more consistent data collection on police use of force around the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.